Hello and welcome to Behind the News. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the world of economics and politics. We've got the usual two segments lined up for tonight. First, in a few minutes, we'll hear an interview recorded earlier this week with James Howard Kunstler, who is the scourge of suburbia and the prophet of doom for our oil-based civilization. We'll talk about those issues and what he sees as the coming dark times and what can be done about it, if anything. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll speak with Jeffrey Perry, who is the author, an independent scholar, who is the author of a new biography of Hubert Harrison, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism, 1883 to 1918, a book just published by Columbia University Press. And we'll talk to him about a fellow who is not quite as well known as many other voices of Harlem radicalism. So Jeffrey Perry aims to fix that, and we'll help him in that struggle. All right, since time is pretty tight tonight, let me keep the opening comments short. How about that for bipartisanship? After sweetening from our president, after all that sweet talking from our president with tax cuts and lubricated with cocktails of the White House, still the stimulus package didn't get a single Republican vote in the House. They won't play bipartisan. They're stubborn as hell and stick to their cretinous principles. You've got to respect them for that. It may be because they have some principles, as nutty as those can be. Meanwhile, the infrastructure component of the stimulus bill has shrunk and is really not up to the task. According to a new report on the nation's infrastructure from the American Society of Civil Engineers, our infrastructure overall gets a grade of D. Out of 15 components, the highest grade goes to solid waste, which America really specializes in, and that gets a C+. There's one D+, five Ds, and five D-minuses. The Society of Civil Engineers estimates that it would take about $2.2 trillion to bring our national infrastructure up to snuff. The bill that passed the House has only about $40 to $60 billion, depending upon whose estimates you believe, for infrastructure. And only about $10 billion of that is for mass transit. Barely a start, even. Turning to another disappointing spending program, yeah, it's nice to see the Obama administration force Citigroup to cancel its order for a $50 million executive jet. But otherwise, life goes on pretty much as usual. An Associated Press review of some 200 banks that got TARP money from Washington found that 87% of their top execs are still on the job, even though many of them made disastrous decisions that drove their institutions into the ground. Wells Fargo, a heavy investor in subprime mortgages, which announced a $2.5 billion loss for the last quarter of 2008, which got $25 billion from the Gov, has not only kept its CEO on the job, they've waived their mandatory retirement age for him. Asked for comment by AP, a Wells Fargo spokesman praised the bank's unchanging vision. In fact, the comments are some of the best parts of the AP story, which ran on Tuesday. A flack for Cleveland-based KeyCorp, another major subprime payer who's gotten TARP money, said, "The on-the-record comment I would make is that we declined to comment, even though we'd like to, because we don't have time." Many of these banks have shed hundreds, even thousands of workers, but not the guys at the top. We'll see if the new administration twists some arms to change this, but I have my doubts. On the non-changiness of changiness, the new Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner, who presided over several major mistakes while he was president of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York, issued some rules on Tuesday restricting contacts with lobbyists and then hired a former Goldman Sachs lobbyist as his chief of staff. Goldman's tentacles continue to extend deep into the government. Earlier in the week, the New York Fed, the most important of the 12 regional banks in the Federal Reserve System because of its intimate relation with Wall Street, announced that Geithner's successor as president of the bank will be William Dudley, a former Goldman Sachs economist. Dudley's really not a bad guy at all, but it's getting harder to tell the difference between Goldman and the government these days. Meanwhile, the New York State Comptroller's Office revealed on Wednesday that Wall Street paid out over $18 billion in bonuses for 2008, an average of $112,000 per worker. That average is very deceptive, since clerical workers might get as little as zero, while the big guys get the millions. But these numbers are still quite big. While the average is down 36% from last year, it's still the sixth highest on record after adjusting for inflation. It's 15% above the 1999 average, which was just before the peak of the dot-com boom. And it's almost four times the 1987 average, adjusted for inflation, remember, which was the peak of the 1980s boom. Clearly, once you reach a certain level in American society, there's no price to be paid for failure. Sam Stein of the Huffington Post got a hold of a recording of a conference call among some retailers and Wall Street analysts trying to build corporate opposition to the Employee Free Choice Act. a bill in Congress that would make it easier to organize workers into unions. Instead of having to go through a complex electoral process, which employers can manipulate, all you'd need is a majority of workers signing cards saying they'd like to join. As you might imagine, employers hate this. But one of the interesting things about the call is the frustration expressed by participants at the passivity of so many CEOs. It's clear from this and many other instances that capitalists would rather run their businesses and make money than get deeply involved in politics. As Stein points out, at least two of the participants were from firms that got federal bailout money, Bank of America and AIG. Nice, isn't it? But the star of the conference call is Bernie Marcus, the co-founder of the anti-union Home Depot. Here are some choice samples from the call.
To pay for the programs that they're going to put in, they're going to have to get the money somewhere, and the unions will go after anybody who works for a living and makes a living. There's no question about it. That Joe the plumber, whatever the hell he does for a living, is going to pay for this in the future along with everybody else. This is the demise of a civilization. This is how a civilization disappears. If a retailer has not gotten involved with this, if he has not spent money on this election, if he has not sent money to Norm Coleman and all these other guys, should be shot. Trying to get CEOs to understand this, and so far, some of them have come out of their deep sleep. Most of them have not come out of their deep sleep. Hopefully, calls like this will stir up the pot. As a shareholder, if I knew the CEO of a company wasn't doing anything on something that was going to have a dramatic effect on my business, I'd sue the son of a bitch.
And that's the voice of Bernie Marcus, co-founder of Home Depot. The demise of civilization, indeed. All right, let's take a musical break. A church, a liquor store, an auto repair shop, that deathly landscape that so characteristic of the United States, oh, much of it. And I think I used that song last time I had James Kunstler on this radio show a few years ago. James Kunstler is the author of many books, 18 novels, and a number of tracks on the future of civilization, the geography of nowhere, one of his most recent novels, World Made by Hand. Anyway, I thought it'd be a good time to talk to him now that the oil price is way down, but the economy is in the tank. So this interview recorded earlier this week, James Howard Kunstler. Welcome, Jim Kunstler. How does it feel to see oil prices down about two-thirds from their peak?
Well, it's clearly an anomalous situation, and I think that the crowd that I run with expected to see some pretty severe distortions in the oil markets at exactly the time that, and under the exactly the kind of circumstances that we've got, which is to say a crisis in capital. So As the capital markets destabilized, the oil markets have likewise destabilized.
So then we're not going to be forced into a new future by high energy prices, but by deflation and economic collapse?
No, I think that this anomalous fall in energy prices will reverse at some point, and not too far down the road. We've overshot in the low direction as much as we may have overshot last July in the high direction. And somewhere more in the middle, like $75 or $80, may be the benchmark for where we're heading. Although I have a somewhat different view of this than some of my friends and colleagues. I think that we're likely to see supply problems and shortages as much as we're likely to see a renewed increase in oil prices. So the thing to look out for will be supply supply disruptions occurring at the same time that the price of oil begins to resume its march upward.
If the U.S. and the rest of the world stays in recession for any length of time, it gets worse, and then China joins in, wouldn't this severely reduce oil demand and we wouldn't see the kind of shortages that you're expecting?
Well, it's hard to say exactly what the baseline for oil demand really is, because any way you cut it, the population of the Earth is still growing rather robustly, and especially the non-American and European parts of the world are using much, much more oil, even if they're having problems in their economies. It remains to be seen how the equation between the capital meltdown and the oil markets is actually going to work. But there is a relationship between them. Obviously, they affect each other. Many of us expected to see this condition that we call the bumpy plateau, where oil production for all time will have peaked, and we would see a kind of bumpy sequence of responses to peak oil, and then high prices crushing economies, and then crushed economies bringing the oil price down, and then economies responding to supernaturally low oil prices and resuming their activity in a set of bumps that until we really headed into permanent decline. But what's happened, actually, is in the first cycle of this bumpy plateau, we have seen one of the most important of our complex systems completely come apart, and that is the capital finance system. I don't think that we anticipated that it would be that we'd see such a train wreck of capital finance just during the first cycle of this, and that's sort of changed everything, and it's a little hard to see where we're going with that.
I want to come back to this point, but just one thing. You are, I believe, a skeptic on alternative energy. The new administration is making this a centerpiece of their economic recovery proposals. What do you think is going to come of that?
I wouldn't necessarily say I'm a skeptic. I think we're going to use everything that we can, and I hate to be misunderstood about this, and you know, one of my cardinal tenets is that it's impossible to overstate people's capacity for misunderstanding. My position on alternative fuels is that we will attempt to avail ourselves of everything that we possibly can. You know, solar, nuclear, wind, tidal, you name it. However, I believe that we're going to be disappointed in what these things can actually do for us. And the main source of our disappointment will come from our expectation that we can keep running all of the stuff we're now running by other means. This is the main fantasy that you're seeing now about the whole happy motoring system.
Now, getting back to your point about the disruption of the capital markets, it must be kind of satisfying to you. I don't want to attribute schadenfreude to you, but it must be kind of intellectually satisfying to see that the origin of this disruption is in the mortgage market, and a lot of those mortgages went to finance extreme ex-urban, suburban-style development. What would you reflect on that for us?
Well, I was writing about the fiasco of suburbia in several books even before the global oil predicament became generally into the arena of discussion. You know, I published a book called The Geography of Nowhere in 1993, and it was all about this living arrangement we had ramped up that had no future. I wouldn't say it's satisfying to watch my society begin to come apart, but you could see this coming from a million miles away. You know, Doug, life is tragic. Life is tragic, and history doesn't care if societies make poor choices and then have to face the consequences of them. It happens frequently, if not always. That's the predicament that we're stuck in. You know, we made a set of very poor choices over about a 70-year period to become a car-dependent, to live in a car-dependent a daily arrangement, and to invest all of our wealth in the infrastructure for this. You know, now it's turning out that it may not work too well for us, and it's very hard for us to go back and reconstruct the kind of human ecology that has a future you know, namely walkable communities, towns and cities that are scaled appropriately for the energy diet of the future, an agricultural landscape that is not utterly dependent on petroleum products. And this is going to be a very difficult transition for us.
Leaving aside the ecological issues around suburbs, you see a very high social and aesthetic cost to suburbia, suburbanization. And just review that for people in the audience who are not familiar with your work.
Well, you know, suburbia comes along really hand in hand with the extremities of single-use zoning in the early 20th century. And the idea is that you're going to disaggregate all of the mixed uses of daily life, you know, the commerce and the residences and the office activities and the industrial activities, and you're going to highly rationalize isolating them all in their particular places. You know, the housing will all take place in the housing tracts, and the commerce will all take place at the mall or the office. You know, the office park will be where you go to work, and none of these things will be connected in any integral way anymore. And in doing this, we really destroyed exactly the kind of rewarding human urban habitats that worked best for people and were proven to be successful over thousands of years. And we created a new kind of Frankenstein living arrangement that was an experiment. And it is now proving to be an experiment that's failed, or that is failing. If nothing else, it was absolutely dependent on supplies of cheap and abundant fossil fuels, and that's exactly the wall that it's running up against. But it had plenty of deficiencies of its own, and they included things like the extreme alienation of people who were living in the context of no particular kind of community that they could identify with. It tended to punish children and old people. Children were not able to use these suburban environments without the help of the family chauffeur. You know, they couldn't go from the clarinet lesson to their home, you know, on their own. And this had a terrible effect on the development of their personal sovereignty. Old people who had lost their driver's licenses or for one reason or another were not able to drive around suffered in suburbia in isolation. I think that there was a general sense of a loss of civic meaning, and you heard this expressed incessantly in these discussions of places that people said, you know, there was no community there, there was no sense of community there. People felt these things, but they couldn't really articulate it. And of course, the suburban living arrangement became so normal throughout our society across this giant continent-sized nation that it was all that people knew for the most part. You know, and by the time you get to the 1980s, most of our cities, with a few exceptions, had been gutted and destroyed. And so very few people even knew what a rewarding kind of urban environment was. And the disinvestment in American cities was ongoing and chronic, and it just made our cities worse and worse and worse until, you know, you end up with places like Detroit and Kansas City and St. Louis and Dayton, Ohio, and Columbus, and Minneapolis, having very little left at their centers, being kind of functionally deactivated. So it's been quite an adventure and quite an experiment, and large parts of the experiment are now in failure mode. And we have to, you know, when Mr. Obama talks about change, you know, this is one of the changes we face. How do we reconstruct a living arrangement for America that really has a future?
Now, I read in the Times this morning that our new president is a fan of Emerson's self-reliance. We have this, you know, the kind of suburban structures you're talking about created a consciousness, a subjectivity of pseudo-self-reliance. Do you see any signs of awakening to the fact that their way of life is in crisis, or are they just so structured that they can't see it?
Well, I think that you do see distress expressed in a lot of peculiar ways. You know, whether it's guys at the gym where I go being absolutely covered with tattoos, you know, normal working guys turning into barbarians. And in just, you know, the behavior of teenagers and adults, too, and the idea that, you know, anything goes and nothing matters in our culture, I think is pretty vivid. But mostly, I think what you see is, again, what I have called the psychology of previous investment. The fact that we're so sunk in our habits and practices that we can't imagine getting out of it. All we can imagine is desperately finding some magic rescue remedy to continue living this way. You know, to continue the 45-mile commutes and the NASCAR races and, you know, all the cheese doodle eating and the obesity and all the meaningless motoring and all the credit card buying and the chain stores. You know, the fact is this whole way of life is comprehensively coming to an end. We're going to have to live really differently in this country, and we're totally unprepared for it. And this leads me to a consideration of, you know, what kind of violent reaction are we going to see when, as it becomes obvious that we have a problem, that we're not going to be able to continue running these rackets, and that things have to change. And I think that there's plenty of room for social upheaval and conflict between different groups in this country.
I'm speaking with James Howard Kunstler, who is the author of World Made by Hand, The Long Emergency, and The Geography of Nowhere. So what kind of future do you see us heading towards?
Well, let's say there are plenty of plausible scenarios you could spin out. And I actually did, in one sense, you know, I wrote a book last year. I published a novel set in the post-oil American future. It's called World Made by Hand. And what has happened in that story is that it takes place in a small town in upstate New York, and the economy of the U.S. has really become more or less centered on agriculture again, and has fallen back quite a ways. You know, the electricity is flickering out, communication is poor, people are living extremely locally. Now, that was only one kind of version of you know, you could spin out many different scenarios that would be plausible. I do think that we're going to run into enormous problems with food production very soon, and not just because of petro-agribusiness. In this year alone, and as far ahead as I can see, I think we're going to be having very bad problems with credit in farming. I think it's going to be in really short supply, and the kind of, you know, our farming practices, our agribusiness system, absolutely requires on huge amounts of credit to get these crops in. So I think that just within a year, we may be encountering food shortages in the U.S., and it's going to come as quite a shock to people.
What if we all did the smart thing and the right thing and the sensibly long-term thing? How would we solve our problem?
Well, there are too many angles to this for, you know, any individual to feel really marvelously confident that he's making a difference. But there are things that we do all have to sort of get on board with. One of my big ones is this. You know, we're now facing a stimulus package in the early phase of the Obama administration. And the stimulus package is aimed at highway construction and reconstruction and things related to that. This is a very unfortunate project. You know, what we need to direct our money to right now, whatever remaining money, dwindling money we have, is we need to fix the passenger railroad system in this country, or we're not going to be going anywhere. The airlines will be going down pretty soon as we know them. The airlines as we know them, I predict, within 48 months, the airlines as we know them will not be there for us. And we are going to run into, again, shortages and price problems with gasoline and diesel fuel. And if we don't get the railroad system running in this country, we're not going anywhere. That should be at the top of the list of the things that the Obama administration does. We have to get started right away on the reform of agriculture. We have to find some way of taking the subsidies away from the big agribusiness guys and doing everything we can to promote local agriculture in the places where that's possible. You know, and we have to start talking straight to the American people and clue them in to what it is that they're actually facing, the pretty severe changes in their way of life.
the kind of crises that you're talking about couldn't support a country of more than 300 million people or a world of more than 6 billion people. Is there going to be some sort of vast die-off in our future?
I think that there's a lot of I think that there's a lot of concern. How can I say this? I think there's a lot of valid concern about this. And every time I give a college talk, there's always somebody who says, who gets up and says in the question and answer period, oh, you didn't talk about population at all. And generally, I don't talk about it because for two reasons. One is we're not going to do a damn thing about it. And two, it's self-evident where we're going with this to anybody who thinks about it for more than 11 seconds. Okay? I think it's true and that there's a lot of agreement that we've exceeded the carrying capacity of the planet and that we're going to have to probably see a lot of attrition in human population. Now, what is certain to happen is that the usual suspects will come out and take care of that for us. And the usual suspects are starvation, war and conflict, disease, compromised immune systems, things like that. You know, there's not going to be any policy or protocol in the U.S. for limiting births. That's not going to happen. But this process of attrition doesn't necessarily have to be an apocalyptic process. And I think we saw a preview of this in what happened with the former Soviet Union. As the years went by since 1990 and the former Soviet Union sort of devolved into Russia, they lost about 25 or 30 million in population. And yet, you know, there were no big headlines in the Washington Post every year saying, catastrophic fall in Russian population. You didn't see that because what happened was people at the margins just sort of slipped through the cracks. And, you know, the people who had made the unfortunate choice to be alcoholics, of whom there were many in Russia, you know, the very old, the pensioners, the war veterans, the people who had compromised immune systems from sexually transmitted diseases, and, you know, probably some people who weren't eating very well. And yet, you know, it wasn't presented to the world as apocalypse. And I think that we may see, if we're lucky, you know, it'll occur that way.
A friend of mine read The World Made by Hand had a reaction to it that he found it rather disturbing, that you idealize a small-town kind of New England model that doesn't allow for a whole lot of diversity of population and kind of fits in with a nativist reactionary worldview.
Well, I'm not a nativist myself. I don't belong to any groups that espouse that. I just wanted to create a plausible community of, you know, people who are recognizable. It was a diverse community in the sense that there were competing bands or competing factions in the town. One of the main features of the story is, at the very beginning, a group of evangelical Christians from the Deep South arrive in town. In order to escape the disorders that are going on in the Sun Belt. And they buy the decommissioned high school and they move in. And their whole culture, their whole scene is very different from the scene among the townspeople. And it's, you know, a source of conflict.
And is there any room for big cities in your future? Because, you know, New York City is very energy efficient. We could lay waste to the suburbs and turn them back into farmland.
You know, there was an article in the New Yorker magazine about 3 or 4 years ago that really messed with a lot of people's minds. It was an article that said something to the effect that New York is the most ecologically sound and green living arrangement in America because you can stack so many people on one building footprint in a skyscraper. This is total bullshit. And very misleading, and unfortunately a lot of people now have developed this idea, because we're going to discover that the skyscraper is an obsolete building form as we get further into the energy problem. And I think what we're going to see is this. You know, our cities are where they are largely because they occupy important sites. And something will be there, so maybe even a big city. But they won't be as big as the cities we know now. Our cities are not scaled for the energy diet of the future. And the ones that are most car-dependent and the ones that are most suburbanized, like Houston and Dallas and Orlando and Atlanta, are the ones that are going to be subject to the greatest contraction. And what I think you're going to see is that our big cities are going to substantially contract, even while they densify at their old centers and waterfronts, where that's possible. And I believe that most of the action is going to be in the smaller cities. We are going to reactivate the places like Dayton and Saginaw and Utica, New York, and even the small towns. And I think that we will see the agricultural landscape inhabited very differently, because farming will require a lot more human attention in the years ahead. The places that do not exist in a meaningful relationship with an agricultural hinterland are not going to make it. You know, the places like Phoenix, Arizona, and Las Vegas will dry up and blow away.
But it takes a lot of car driving to get around a place like Dayton.
Well, as it's currently constituted, it takes a lot of car driving to get around any place in America. What, you know, what you're going to see is that the places that have the ability to densify and become integral and compact will be successful. But you know, unfortunately, the places like Houston and Atlanta have very little of that in the first place. You know, they're mostly composed of automobile-dependent fabric. So, you know, it's going to be necessarily problematical for these places. There will probably be some place, there will be something in these places. There may be even substantial towns, but they're not going to be what they have been in our time. They're going to be different, and we're going to see, I think, some striking demographic shifts.
Well, I certainly wouldn't shed a tear if I saw Houston and Phoenix emptying, that's for sure.
Well, and you're making an important point here, because one of the problems that we have made for ourselves, and one of the reasons I wrote The Geography of Nowhere, is that we created so many places in this country that aren't worth caring about. When you say no one will shed a tear for it, you know, no one would say that about Paris. But in America, you know, we have thousands of cities that are composed of nothing more than six-lane commercial strip mall boulevards. And nobody will shed a tear for those places. We won't miss them.
And that's the voice of James Howard Kunstler, the author most recently of A World Made by Hand, and also The Long Emergency and The Geography of Nowhere, and many, many other books. I think Kunstler is a very interesting and entertaining fellow to listen to, but I still have some serious problems with his perspective. I didn't edit out the ums and the pauses in his answer to my question about a population die-off because I wanted to make clear the anxiety that a lot of people of his persuasion feel on the topic. My guess is that a lot of them just don't like large agglomerations of people very much and would be, if not happy, then somehow perversely satisfied to see them reduced. He didn't really answer the question on nativism and a lack of diversity at all. And New York City is, despite his bleepable assertion to the contrary, highly energy efficient. We emit more than 70% less than the U.S. average of greenhouse gases, which are a good proxy for fossil fuel consumption, and almost 40% less than those eco-freaks in San Francisco. My own feeling is that the best approach to maintaining a comfortable material standard of living compatible with avoiding ecological catastrophe is to re-urbanize the population and create green belts around cities. I agree with Kunstler that suburbs are alienating and ecocidal, but small towns are far less energy efficient than more densely populated regions because density makes walking and mass transit possible. But our visions of the future often do embody our personal preferences, don't they? Okay, let's take a musical break, and we'll be back to talk about Hubert Harrison. And that sum of Bach's English Suite number 2, the Bourée, from that performed by Martha Argerich. And I forgot to say, this is WBAI in New York, 99.5 on your FM dial and also on the web at WBAI.org. And if you do visit the website, please click on the donate button and help us through our own long emergency. And this is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're now joined in the studio by Hubert Harrison's biographer, which is Jeffrey Perry, author of the book Hubert Harrison, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism, 1883 to 1918, just recently published by Columbia University Press. Welcome, Jeffrey.
Thank you.
And a resident of my former hometown, I understand.
We'll be speaking on Harrison at the public library this Saturday.
Wow.
So come on home.
Well, well, welcome. Hubert Harrison, certainly not one of the more familiar names, even to students of American radicalism. So give us the capsule bio. Where did he was an immigrant, not a native-born American, right?
Right. Hubert Harrison lived from 1883 to 1927. He was born in St. Croix in the Virgin Islands, came to New York City as a 17-year-old orphan in 1900, and died in 1927 at age 44 in Bellevue Hospital from an appendicitis attack. He was a brilliant and influential class and race-conscious writer, orator, educator, critic, and political activist. One of the reasons so much attention is now being paid to him is his political contributions were unique in United States history. He played leading roles in what were, at that time, the largest class radical movement, socialism, and the largest race radical movement, the New Negro / Garvey movement in U.S. history of his era, and some historians say up to that time. He was the principal radical influence on both Marcus Garvey and A. Philip Randolph. And when I come of age, a little before you in the 60s, that's the two wings of the Black liberation struggle. Now, the historian Joel A. Rogers, also, his World's Great Men of Color has been published, I think, in 5 editions now, refers to Harrison as the foremost Afro-American intellect of his era and the one with the sanest program. A. Philip Randolph refers to him as the father of Harlem radicalism, which is where the title derives from in part. And Arthur Schomburg, who was a pallbearer at Harrison's massive funeral, and his funeral in Harlem had 2,000 people attending, and Schomburg, who was on the founding committee of what is now the Schomburg Library with Harrison, they were 2 of the 4 officers. They each contributed books. Schomburg contributed many books. Harrison would speak regularly at the library, and Schomburg said with much foresight that Hubert Harrison was ahead of his time, and I think when people get to read some of his writings and learn his life story, he has many things. I mean, his comments on war, for instance, what he said during the era of Woodrow Wilson rings so true, you know, during the recent era of George W. Bush. And Harrison is one of the themes in the biography is that Harrison is the key ideological link in the 2 strands of the Black liberation movement. They come together in Harrison's presence. He was also an extraordinary intellectual. He edited a number of publications, including The Masses, which was the preeminent left literary publication in the decade between 1910 and 1920. His newspaper, The Voice, was the first paper, and his organization, the Liberty League, the first newspaper and organization of the New Negro Movement, which in some ways is comparable to the Black Power movement of the 60s. This was during World War I. He also was the principal editor of Garvey's Negro World when it swept the globe in 1920. Harrison is also famous as a street corner orator. I showed you when I came in today when he spoke for 3 hours at Wall and Broad Street right down the block on socialism 97 years ago. And when he was a socialist, I've been able to track weeks where he spoke as many, over 21 times a week, morning, noon, and night on socialism.
That's capital S with the party, right?
Yes, with the Socialist Party. But he wound up breaking from the party principally over white supremacy, yeah, not simply towards Black people, but also towards Asians, and I go into that in the book.
I do want to get to that topic. So, but after, you know, this, yeah, you recount this very impressive biography, a very impressive resume, mm-hmm, and high regard he was held in his time and immediately after. Why was he now so obscure?
Yeah, very good question. The standard reasons, he's Black, he's poor, he's immigrant, he's working class, you know, people who have been slighted by history. He's also a a forthright critic of many people. He was quite outspoken.
He didn't know his work well with others, did he?
Huh? He's actually a very charming person and got along well with people.
But and he liked the ladies, too.
That's and in the biography, I try and draw a complete picture. I mean, yeah. I think we learn from that. But he was very forthright in his criticisms, and he criticized the leading left organizations, leading black organizations, and leaders of all of them. But most of his criticisms I find to be very well-founded. And what's interesting, and I pay particular attention to this, is his training after he came to the U.S. was in black working class intellectual circles in that first decade in New York. And there were some, you know, fascinating people who played very prominent roles in New York City history and black history. And it was a good training. You know, they'd have forums and debates and lyceums.
Talk a little bit about that milieu that he entered. It sounded like it was pretty lively.
Yeah. Well, when Harrison comes, he's an orphan. And one of the things he does, the black community, when Harrison first arrives, he lived on 62nd Street, which was an area of black before the IRT was completed and people
on the west side.
Yeah, right. Still on 63rd Street, you'll see the street named after Thelonious Monk, right? Because Monk grew up on 63rd, Harrison on 67. They were some years apart. And then when the IRT is completed in 1904, people started, you know, moving in mass, you know, up to Harlem. But so on 53rd Street, there were two churches, St. Benedict the Moor and St. Mark's, that had active lyceums, debates, speakers coming in, left speakers, you know, community speakers, national issues, tariff. They would talk women's suffrage, all, you know, burning issues of the day. And in those lyceums, some of the people I mentioned, and I try to pay particular attention to a lot of the working class intellectuals of that period, but Schomburg is one, and he's the principal founder of the library, which is a preeminent black library in the world, the one on New York Public Library, 135th Street. John E. Bruce, who's a leading black journalist. Williana Jones Burroughs, people may not know about her. She was a New York City teacher. And in 1909, when she married Charles Burroughs, an actor, friend of Harrison's, a postal worker like Harrison, she was forced to give up her teaching position for 16 years because there was a New York State law prohibiting married women from teaching. And she later, just to tie it into our radio show here, became a broadcaster in the Soviet Union from 1931 to 45, and during World War II, when Soviet Union was our ally. Charles Burroughs was another one of the intellectual activists. So this was the circle that Harrison was moving in, and it was one, as I said, where there was a lot of discussion, debate, and a very, very forthright approach to dealing with issues. And Harrison, I didn't mention, but he was an autodidact. He finished high school, and the headlines in the one of the dailies was "Genius Found in West Indian Pupil." He was working 5 days a week and a few nights, and scored citywide honors. But he, for various reasons, didn't go to school. One, Jay Rogers says it was because of money, but I think it was also because he was quite fulfilled. He kind of lived the life of an autodidact, you know, and it was said that he read as many as 6 books a day. He spoke reportedly or read 6 to 8 languages. He, according to Ernestine Rose, who was a librarian at the 135th Street Library, nobody took out more books than Harrison did. I mean, he was a genuine intellectual.
And he had a distinctive prose style to go
with. Yeah, brilliant. He's a brilliant writer. And another thing that a lot of people are not familiar with, he's the first regular black book reviewer in history. Now, I put out a reader, about 138 articles from Wesleyan University Press in 2001. And we have commitment now from Columbia University for me to put all 700 of his writings that we've been able to locate up on the web in a permanent searchable database for free worldwide. And this is, you know, I mean,
how far along are you in that project?
Well, I've got most of the writings. I just have to – it's the technical, you know, moving and proofing everything. But I've been working over 20 years on this, so a lot of the work is done.
I should say I'm speaking with Jeffrey Perry, who is the author of Hubert Harrison, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism, 1883 to 1918, published by Columbia University Press. And just a few words about yourself. You did not take a conventional scholarly route, did you?
No. I'll talk about myself in a second. But one more thing, if I may, Doug.
Sure.
This book, I don't think I mentioned this. This is the first volume of a 2-volume biography on Harrison, right? And the second one hopefully will be out within 2 or 3 years. I believe it's the first multi-volume of an Afro-Caribbean and only the 5th of an African-American. So Columbia University Press is also making a big commitment on this. As far as myself, no, I'm not a tradition. I mean, I'm, you know, born in the Bronx and working class family, truly working class family, first one to ever go to college. But I finished my undergraduate degree and traveled through Latin America. It's different. I don't know how much.
And then ended up working in a post office.
Yeah, huh? 33 years in the post office. I was active for many years. Fired pre-PATCO for striking. We're not allowed to strike, right? Federal employees or quasi-federal employees. So we were fired in 1978. Took on some mob influence in one of the unions, you know, that was in the Postal Service. So I was very active. I worked at the bulk mail center in Jersey City, 4,000 workers for a while. I was the elected union head of that facility, and we waged very good campaigns. And we, in the work we did, we really put a lot of emphasis on the fight against white supremacy, which was very, in some way, I mean, it actually sunk wonderful roots out there in Jersey City, and we tried to extend that, and we had some successes.
Yeah. And another of your scholarly activities is the work of Theodore Allen, right?
Right. Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. In some ways, I've spent the last 30 years focusing on the work of two people that I consider the most important anti-racist, anti-capitalist writers and thinkers of the 20th century. Hubert Harrison, the Afro-Caribbean at the beginning, Theodore W. Allen towards the end of the 20th century. Allen and both people, I had their papers. We've placed Harrison's papers at Columbia, and there's a 102-page finding aid available online. I'll give you this information later. And I have Allen's papers, and I'm trying to place them. For those who are not familiar with Allen, he wrote many things, some things that were influential way back in the 60s and 70s. His most important work is his two-volume The Invention of the White Race, published by Verso in 1994 and 1997. I also have a little pamphlet that with Mike Zweig we published it's a pamphlet on that theme from the 1970s, and it was out at SUNY Stony Brook for the Center for the Study of Working Class Life. And Allen's focus is on Allen's a Marxist economist, right? And he taught at the Jefferson School. He wrote a wonderful series, which I think you personally would be interested in the late 50s, on imperialism, kind of breaking from some of the economic positions developed by the party in the late 50s, and wrote some wonderful critiques of Perlow in the 70s and more, you know, a number of things. And with that training, he focused on 17th century Virginia and Maryland in developing his thesis that the white race was invented as a ruling class response to labor unrest in the 17th century with European and African Americans. There were 14 laboring class and bond servant revolts between 1660 and 1676 in Virginia. The largest was Bacon's Rebellion, the second stage, the Civil War stage, in which 400 Europeans and Negroes in arms demanded their freedom from chattel bond servitude. Allen's work details a whole history that most people are not familiar with. We did not have slavery in this country full-blown, as many people think, and as was, you know, the roots image, you know, that there's a full-blown system. It developed, and for most of the 17th century in the pattern-setting colonies of Virginia and Maryland, things were quite different than most people assume. Lerone Bennett, Jr., editor of Ebony, does a pretty nice job on this in his book, The Shaping of Black America, also.
All right, let's get back to Hubert Harrison. Talk about his relation to some of the other figures of the time. He did not get along with Booker T. Washington, right?
No. He criticized Booker T. Washington openly in 1910. He felt Washington's philosophy was one of subservience in all areas, politics, economics. Harrison criticizes Washington in 1910 when Washington goes to Europe and says everything is fine back home. This is when there's segregation, lynching, and disfranchisement, you know, marring the land. Du Bois also criticized Washington at this time, but Harrison wrote two letters to the New York Sun, a daily, and Booker T. Washington had a political machine, the Tuskegee machine, and he had Harrison summarily fired from his postal employment. I was able, as a postal unionist, to dig up his POD-7, and he had a clean record. You know, I used to deal with grievances all the time. Harrison had a clean record, and he was summarily fired, you know, for speaking
out. The post office keeps records that
long.
Yeah,
And so Harrison, and that was a devastating blow, because he wound up having five children, right? And at the time, he had two and His wife was pregnant with a third. So it's a devastating blow. So, yeah, he had...
And he lived the rest of his life pretty poor.
Yeah, he lived in total poverty, as did Alan, you know,
Yeah, well, I'd heard that Alan was actually dependent on Verso royalties. So I heard it,
yeah.
That's pretty desperate. Yeah, yeah. if they pay them at all. What about his – well, let's talk about his time with the Socialist Party since
sure.
we don't have much time.
When Harrison joined the Socialist Party, less than 1% were people of African descent. He learned from the examples of the work with immigrants and women, where autonomous movements, an autonomous women's movement and foreign language federations and special approaches to women and immigrants had led to some significant gains in membership. And he tried to do a similar thing in the Socialist Party, forming a colored socialist club. He also developed some of the theoretical analyses later picked up by the Communist Party in the 20s and 30s. He writes the first major theoretical analysis of socialism and the Negro, you know, things like this by an African American. Active with he also moves to the left in the party, and he's active with Gurley Flynn and Big Bill Haywood in the Patterson strike of 1913. But on the Negro question, he differs from Debs, who was a leader of the party and pretty well respected, because Debs took the position that the party was colorblind and there should be no special efforts made towards, you know, African Americans. Harrison wanted special emphasis. He thought that the Negro question was a revolutionary question. Why this is important is when Harrison joined the party, the big debate was, would socialism come by revolutionary or evolutionary means? A secondary debate was, should people work within the AFL or in the what was considered the more revolutionary union movement, the IWW? Harrison tried to appeal to both sides in those debates and said that the key task should be to champion the cause of the Negro, that the fight against white supremacy was central in the U.S. Now, I think he's really onto something with this analysis.
But that was not well received in socialist circles.
No, not at the time. And but in some ways, I mean, he when he writes in the Socialist Party Press in 1911 and 12 that true equality and democracy for the Negro implies a revolution startling to even think of, he almost foreshadows what happens at least in the 60s when we see that the civil rights, black liberation struggle gives such energy to so many other movements. But you're right. No, it was not. And then he also opposed the party's position on Asian immigration in 1912 at the convention. He laid before the party the question, Southernism or socialism, which direction do you want to move, you know, white supremacy or you know, champion the cause of people of color. And they came back with a very racist position saying that race views are innate, you know, which Harrison thought was the core.
You've got a quote in there. It was stunning.
Yeah, right. And he never let them forget it for the remainder of his life. But one thing that's good, you know, people do learn a little bit. And I spoke before the social – I've been speaking, you know, in community groups, libraries, and socialists had me. And they're very interested now in reviewing their history and reassessing a little bit, which is good. If I may – one thing, I do have a website that has a lot of information, and I realize WBAI listeners can't all buy the book. So what I encourage is if people think they're interested, try to encourage local libraries to get it. And I have a website, www.jeffreybperry.net, my name. And on it, you can just download for free the first chapter, which lays out an overview of Harrison's life. You'll see lots of different information, schedule of talks. Over the last 2 months, I've done over 3 months, I'll do about 40 or 50 talks, taking them into the communities, Bronx, Brooklyn, Jersey, Virginia, Massachusetts, wherever, you know, into the universities, trade unions, the Central Labor Council in Jersey. So we're trying to bring this issue out a little bit. And if I may, just for one of his quotes – and
he's got about a minute left. So.
Okay, I'll go very quick. He understood the dual nature of democracy in America. And this one quote written during World War I when Woodrow Wilson wants to make the world safe for democracy is the one that rang so true, I think, recently when George Bush talked about bringing democracy to Iraq and the Middle East. And Harrison writes, "During the war, the idea of democracy was widely advertised, especially in the English-speaking world, mainly as a convenient camouflage behind which competing imperialists masked their sordid aims. Those who so loudly proclaimed and formulated the new democratic demands never had the slightest intention of extending the limits of the applications of democracy." And on this and many other things, I think he's very, very insightful.
All right. Well, I highly recommend the book to anyone out there who can either afford it or persuade a library to buy it. The book is Hubert Harrison, The Voice of Harlem Radicalism, 1883 to 1918, published by Columbia University Press. And we've been speaking with the author, Jeffrey B. Perry. And that website again, Jeffrey B. Perry.
www.jeffreybperry.net.
Yes. All right. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Not sure whether I'll be here next week or not, but I'll be back sometime. Okay, let's go out with this from Rhythm King and Her Friends, The Front of Luxury. Bye.